An epic flood is churning down the Mississippi. As it heads for New Orleans, who decides what gets flooded and what stays dry? This hour, we'll talk about how the Army Corps' master plumbers are trying to manage the river's flow. Spare the cities? Flood the farmland? Is more engineering the answer or the problem? Is it time to give the river more room? And can we expect more of the same due to climate change? As rainy seasons get longer, storms get more intense, can we expect more frequent floods? Then investigating the mysteries of schizophrenia by modeling the way it thinks with computers. And remember burning stuff with a magnifying glass? You don't want to miss this week's video pick, Summer Science, The Physics of Frying Leaves, after the break. Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE. Here's another free offer, Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite is designed to automatically back up files on PCs and Macs before hard drive crashes, viruses, or other problems occur. To try it free and support the show, visit Carbonite.com and use the offer code Science Friday.
Thank you, Anna. And now, on to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Significant wouldn't really be the right word to describe the flooding along the Mississippi. Epic is more along the right lines, because the river is so swollen that it's breaking records set way back during the great floods of 1927 and 37. The Army Corps of Engineers, which manages all the levees along the river from Canada to New Orleans, is facing tough choices, deciding whose homes and farms to flood, whose to save. Because the big challenge for the Army Corps now, the last stand in this battle, so to speak, is whether to open Louisiana's Morganza Spillway, a floodway that, if opened, would inundate thousands of homes but prevent potentially catastrophic levee breaks along Baton Rouge and New Orleans. How do engineers manage such sophisticated plumbing? How did the river even get this big in the first place? This hour, we're talking about rain, floods, levees, river engineered to be controlled. Could it be overly engineered? Could less flood control be better? And how about climate change? Can we expect flooding like this more often in the future? What do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or go to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave comments there. Let me introduce my guests. Larry Banks is a consulting hydraulic engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers. He's also former chief of water management at the Mississippi Valley Division in Vicksburg, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Peter Glick is president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland, California. That's a research institute that works on climate and water. He's also a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and he joins us from the studios of Youth Radio in Oakland. Welcome back, Dr. Glick.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Ed Link is former director of research and development for the Army Corps and a research professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland in College Park. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Link.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Mr. Banks, let me ask you about this decision. What decision will the Corps be making this weekend about controlling the flooding and opening up the spillways?
Well, the situation right now is that we're monitoring all the water levels within the basin, particularly those down in the Morganza area along the Mississippi River. We've developed a timeline to use in making decisions based on what the river tells us to do. We have an operation procedure that says that we are to regulate the Morganza floodway in order to keep the flows in the main stem of the Mississippi River below Morganza floodway, between Morganza and Baton Rouge, at a flow rate of less than 1.5 million CFS. And when we know that that situation is going to occur, then there'll be some decisions made as to what to do. But that's where we're at right now. We're not ready to say at this moment that we will operate the structure or we won't operate the structure. There is an appreciable amount of flooding occurring in the Atchafalaya Basin right now due to the waters of the Atchafalaya River, and operation of the structure will add a little bit of water to that. And so it's a serious situation. It deserves much thought, but we will not operate the floodway just because it's there and it was designed to be operated as a floodway. We would use it only as it is necessary.
So if you determine that there's a potential for flooding of, let's say, down river like New Orleans, you will then open that up in terms of preventing that kind of catastrophic event.
Yes, that is true.
So that's what you'll be waiting to see, how high the river is and whether that's necessary.
That is correct. And it's due to the vagaries of flow and stage relationships that the river has during an event like this, it's a type of decision that you can't really decide what you're going to do a long time ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of wait on the river, and it's hard to sit here and wait on this flood crest. The tendency is to go ahead and make some decisions, but we have to make sure that mm-hmm. we make the right decision, and we're looking at all alternatives. Will be evaluated before that decision is made.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be based on what the river tells us to do.
All right. Ed Link, you used to work for the Army Corps. Tell us about how this whole levee system works in the Mississippi. It is a river that is engineered, basically, is it not?
Yes, it has been engineered for quite a long time, and the nation made a choice quite a number of decades ago to try to manage flooding by the use of levees. The other alternative would be to not use levees, but that decision is long behind us. So the levees provide a way of containing the river in a controlled channel in an area where hopefully no losses occur. The problem with that is when the river comes up, the only place it has to go is up when there's a large volume of water. So it's a constant analysis of how high do the levees need to be, and the big question is, was the knowledge available when the levees were first designed adequate to cover the spectrum of conditions that the river might present in the future? And that's a big question.
Well, you mean whether we expected a flood of this proportion when they were designed?
Yeah, right. And are even higher floods?
Or higher.
Might we get higher floods in the future? Now, the river has been close to this high a number of times before, not in some areas not this high, but there hasn't been an issue of overtopping of any of the mainline levees yet. Hopefully that won't be an issue here. I think if there's an issue with the levees, it will be seepage of water through the levees that would cause a problem, not overtopping.
You mean the collapse of them by
right,
the seepage?
Right, from water moving under the foundation of the levee.
And what parts of the river might that be most vulnerable to that?
That's typically happens where a levee goes over an old river channel where there's porous material, but the levees are inspected very frequently to look for signs of that and to manage that if that begins to happen.
Mm-hmm. Peter Glick, where did all this water come from? Why is this such an unexpected event?
All of the water came from where it normally comes from. It comes from nature. It comes from the hydrologic cycle. It fell as snow over the last many months in the basin, and the basin is huge. The Mississippi, of course, is one of the great rivers of the world. It covers a huge fraction of the United States. And so there was a tremendous amount of water stored in snow in the basin, which is now melting and flowing down the watershed. But there has also been an unprecedented intensity of rainfall in the last 30 days on top of it. So we have snow melt. We have massive amounts of water in rainfall, unprecedented amounts of water in rainfall just in the last few weeks. And all of that has contributed to the levels we're seeing now along the Mississippi.
It, you know, scientists are not willing to point to weather events as evidence of climate change. Are you willing to point to this this massive flood as evidence of all the factors that you said, the melt, snow melt, the incredible amount of rainfall as evidence that this might be something to expect more of in the future?
Absolutely. Let me put it this way. Climate science tells us unambiguously that we're changing the climate and we're trapping more energy in the atmosphere. We know that trapping more energy will cause more extreme events and will worsen extreme events that would otherwise happen. The way we think about this in the climate community is we call it loading the dice. We're rolling loaded dice weighted toward more extreme and energetic weather. We know through observation that flood frequency is increasing along the Mississippi. We know through observation that the atmosphere is holding a lot more moisture now than it did 20 or 30 or 40 years ago because of global warming. I think the way to think about this now is not attribution. No one is saying the Mississippi floods are caused by climate change. I want to make that clear. But extreme events are unambiguously now influenced by climate change.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, if I hear what you're saying, you're saying that Ed, if I hear what you're saying that these levees are not built for that kind of expectations of the future.
Well, they were built with some analysis of the uncertainty in the water levels that they would have to deal with. The question is, was that uncertainty well enough estimated to deal with unexpected? And I think that's a good question. There's a lot of uncertainty in this type of analysis. We've had floods that you might consider to be extreme, and that is over 100-year or 1% chance per year kind of level, six or seven times in the last 100 years on the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. So that 100-year number is just a made-up figure, calling it a 100-year flood since we've had six or seven times already.
No, I'm saying we've had water elevations along the main stem of the Mississippi that have exceeded what is calculated to be the 1% chance water elevation, the 100-year water elevation. And it's been in different portions of the river, not the whole river. But having high water like this is – this high water is, of course, an extreme. But also another important point along with the – additional energy in the atmosphere is land use. We have, since 1927, there's been a huge change in the land use conditions in the Mississippi Basin, and it is. It's 41% of the contiguous United States. And that land use change has caused more of the water that falls on the landscape and melts from the snow to run off and get into the river channels more rapidly and aggregate more rapidly, and that creates larger floods. So there's two factors working here. One is the potential for more extreme input of water and greater water levels. The other is the fact that that water is now getting into the channel and aggregating and flowing down the river much more quickly. Because of the way we've modified the landscape.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town or on the other side of the country or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and Help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code SCIENCE. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SCIENCE. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the flooding on the Mississippi with my guest Larry Banks, consulting hydraulic engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers, Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland, California, Ed Link, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Maryland in College Park. When we last talked before the break, Ed, you were talking about the land use, and I want to play a clip that we had from a Science Friday back in 1993. You'll remember that flood back there, and we were on the air. And we have this this audio clip from Dr. Victor Baker, who is a professor of hydrology and water resources at the University of Arizona. And back in 93, we knew that the levees weren't going to protect certain areas from these big floods. And this is what he had to say.
I'm very concerned that people think that because there is a large dam in place, because there are levees, that they are protected against all floods, when what really is the case is they are protected against little floods. They are not protected against the biggest possible floods that can occur, and the reason is that society would not stand for how much it would cost to protect those people against the biggest possible floods that would occur.
Ed Link, that was, as I say, that was a clip from Science Friday back in 1993, and you pointed out that people continue to develop and put new homes and buildings on the flood, in the floodplain.
In fact, if you look at the 1993 flood and the area that was inundated, flooded during that flood, there have been 28,000 new homes built back into that area, and some 1,600 acres of new commercial and industrial development in the area that was flooded in 93. That's a problem. That's raising risk. That's putting more assets and more people in jeopardy, and that's a big issue.
Don't people know when they moved to these that they are moving into a floodplain, and this is the Faustian bargain that they're making? They're going to get flooded when a big flood happens?
I would think that that information is certainly available. The problem is how well it's communicated.
Peter, Larry, you've been out in the floodplain a long time. People understand what's happening there?
I think people in the Mississippi Valley that live in the Delta regions all the way from Missouri, all the way down the river, and particularly in Louisiana, understand the importance of the levee system that we have. We've really, since we built this system beginning back in 27 when the Corps got the responsibility through the 28 Flood Control Act. The only real threat that we've had where some serious things was really considered was probably the 73 flood. We had a pretty good event in 2008. The 93 flood that occurred in the upper Mississippi was not really an event, any kind of significant event as it passed through the lower Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. But this event is one that is really taxing the system, and we've got an incomplete system. It's not scheduled to be completed till I'm not sure what the date is right now, 2030s or sometime like that. We got an incomplete system, and we've got a flood that's 85 to 90% of the capacity of what the system has to handle, and the features of the system, the channel improvement features, where we made some enlargements to the channel and some cutoffs back in the 30s and 40s. The revetment program that's kept the river large enough such that it can convey these floods as well as support navigation. And the floodways, which is the place to put the water when you get the levee system full and the levees, are all working in concert in this event. And it's been some tough decisions that have to be made in operating the system. Nobody said it was an easy system to operate, but the system has really performed very well through this very excessive event.
Mm-hmm. Peter, would you agree with that?
Well, without a doubt, the system is operating really well. The part of the problem, of course, is that the system was engineered, massively engineered, with the assumptions of the 20th century. And from a climate perspective, the assumption was that the climate was going to stay the same, that the climate we got in the 20th century was the climate that we were going to get in the 21st century. And we know that's no longer true. So that adds additional stress. Ed made the point earlier that the flood along the Mississippi, and this is true of floods anywhere, are a combination of a lot of different things. They're a combination of the amount of water we get. It's a function of how we've designed the river. It's a function of land use and what we put behind those levees. Mm-hmm. All of those are at play in the Mississippi especially, which is so massively engineered.
But Larry's
point that this is an incomplete system, it's incomplete not just from an engineering perspective but from a management perspective. I don't think we can engineer our way out of these floods. We have to redesign the way we think about letting the floodplains expand. We have to rethink development, and that's not just an engineering question.
You mean it's a public policy question?
It's a public policy question, and it's got to be done in the context, in my opinion, of a changing climate.
And how would that help? Well, what kind of suggestions are you talking about or modifications?
Sure. Well, first of all, we have to work to reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases because the intensity of climate change is a function of what we do on that front. But there are also unavoidable implications of climate. We're already going to see impacts that we cannot avoid. And in that sense, we also have to think about adaptation. We have to think about expanding floodplains. We have to think about reducing the risk of development by preventing people from living right behind levees that, if they get overtopped by more extreme floods, are going to cause a tremendous amount of death or injury or damage. We have to think about adapting to higher temperatures. There are a whole series of non-structural things and structural things that we're going to have to think about that we haven't thought about so far.
Have they thought about this in other countries where they have flooding?
Well, of course, you know, the classic is the Netherlands, where they've thought for many, many years about sea level, and they're now thinking pretty seriously about sea level rise. But that's a good example. Following Katrina, we rebuilt the levees in New Orleans to the same level that they had been built before, and we might have strengthened them. But we didn't take into account future sea level rise. It would have been smart to have increased the height of some of those levees. That's what I mean by we're not really thinking for future climate. We're still thinking about past climate.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Ed. Link, over in the Netherlands, they're working on a project called Room for the River to give the river some of its land back. Would a similar approach be workable here?
Yeah. In fact, I'm on an advisory board for that whole for the Netherlands looking at future climate change and Room for the River. It is a great concept. The Netherlands has found it to be essential because 60% of their country is below sea level. And they have pretty much optimized their plumbing system right now to deal with the water regime that they're currently experiencing. So any significant change like sea level rise and changes in the flow regime on the Rhine River are going to make a big difference to them. So, yeah, the Room for the River is a good concept, but it's also could be very challenging. If you think about widening the levees, widening the space between the levees on the Mississippi, and think about the gaining real estate easements on all of that land, that by itself may be the most challenging project. Moving the levees back is a fairly simple thing to do, not a very inexpensive thing, but a relatively simple thing engineering-wise. But the real estate might be staggering. In New Orleans, the levees were designed considerably higher than they were prior to Katrina, and sea level rise was factored into that. A whole new hurricane climatology was created to define the water elevations that may exist in different locations around New Orleans. And that, in addition to the uncertainty of that, which is considerable, was factored into the elevation of the structures along with sea level rise, along with subsidence of the area, which is a big issue in most deltas. Mm. So those levees are considerably higher. In some cases, prior to Katrina, they were 14 feet, for example, along Lake Bourne on the east side, and now they're 24 or 25 feet high. So there's been a huge difference in what's in place right now and what was there prior to Katrina.
Let's go to the phones. Gary in Wichita, Kansas. Hi, Gary.
Hi. You mentioned the 93 flood, and that was pretty big around here. And I want to reiterate what you said about earlier, that we control this, basically, because the Corps of Engineers has taken this massive flood plain and decided to control it so we can talk about climate change, but we still are responsible because we've chosen to control it. And here in Wichita, we have a floodway that diverts the Little and Big Arc, and they go around the west side of town. The problem is it solved the problem for flooding in Wichita, but it put it downstream. It just basically sends the problem downstream. And up in the upper Missouri, they've dammed up the Missouri, and the consequences of that have been that it's kept some of the silt from replenishing the barrier islands down out in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. And my thing would be is if we're going to control this, maybe we just have to readjust things. Maybe in our floodway, because that thing almost crested. The floodway crested, and the river downtown was already full.
Right.
And maybe we should have had some sort of outlet for that water and a place. But also, the lakes up in Minnesota and so forth, maybe they have to be readjusted to be at a standard 1 foot lower.
Mm-hmm.
So that when we get the high snow melt or we get these problems, that it doesn't just get shoved downstream.
Well, and thanks for calling, because that raises a point I wanted to bring up, and that is why is the power to control so many people's lives and so many acres and so many thousands of homes, why is that controlled by the military? Why is that not a political decision? I mean, we're talking about General Walsh, who is in charge of every levee from Canada to Mississippi, deciding the lives of all these people. And nothing against General Walsh, but isn't that the kind of thing we usually allow elected leaders to do and members of the government so they can be held responsible for that kind of thing?
Well, this is Larry Banks.
I know what you're going to quote me, the law from 1927, and I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying now, you know, 60, 70, 80 years ago, later from when that happened, might it not be a better idea, since there are so many states involved and so many communities involved and people asking about upstream, downstream, Peter, Ed, Larry, why leave it in the hands of one person who makes that decision?
Well, first off, it's not one person that makes all those decisions. We have a commission that's appointed by the president with both civilian officers, NOAA and the commanders throughout the Mississippi Valley and the Ohio River Basin and the Missouri Basin. That commission makes these decisions relative to the Mississippi River and Tributaries Project. But yes, I was going to quote the 1928 Flood Control Act, and there's numerous other acts, the 36, you just go right on down the line. Congress addresses flood control almost every year, and it has been the intent of Congress since that 28 Act to have the Army Corps of Engineers to work this massive system because Congress can give us the resources, and we have access to resources to basically protect the valley during times of perilous flood like what we're going through here. So it's been the intent and the will of Congress to do that, and I think the Army has done a pretty good job in protecting the people of the Mississippi Valley through the events that have occurred over time.
I need to put a station ID in here, okay? So hang on with me. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow with Larry Bangs, Peter Glick, and Ed Link. Yes, go ahead. Is that Ed?
Yeah. No, it's Peter.
Oh, Peter, go ahead.
Ira, I would just point out that these kinds of extreme events are dealt with by a lot of different agencies in a lot of different places. The Army Corps has responsibility on the Mississippi, but of course the Bureau of Reclamation has responsibility in much of the West. Bonneville has responsibility in the Pacific Northwest, the TVA in the Southeast. It is an indication that, in fact, our national water policy is pretty fragmented. There are a lot of different agencies responsible for a lot of different pieces of this. But overall, it's just true that we're not adequately thinking about how to deal with these new extremes.
The other item here is a caller made a very good point. You have to look at these types of problems from a systems perspective. You can't just look at resolving a flooding issue in one city like Wichita. You have to look at the entire watershed. You have to try to balance what's going on to not solve one problem and create another. And the ability to do that system-wide kind of analysis is unfortunately just been emerging over the last decade. And a lot of the attention that was paid in the past was solving more local kinds of problems. And the Mississippi River is one of the few examples of where it is being managed as a system. There are a few other river systems that are managed this way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, Peter, about the science and climate change and whatever that's involved in mm-hmm. the future. Congress is now cutting budgets, and science is on the budgets in Congress. Are any of the tools that climatologists need going to be suffering in the upcoming budget process?
Well, I think without a doubt they're going to be suffering. Let me draw a distinction between the science and the policy side of this. The scientific community unambiguously understands that we're changing the climate and that we're increasingly loading the dice, as I say, in terms of extreme events. On the policy side, what we choose to do about that is a much more difficult political question. But recently, the budget cuts, in a sense, have started to blind us to just the kind of information that we need to prepare for these extreme events. So, for example, NOAA has one satellite, one polar orbiting satellite that looks at extreme weather events, that monitors snow and rain and flooding, that's used for emergency response for the military, that's used for all sorts of critical things. And these satellites, this one satellite, has instruments that fail over time. Congress just cut the budget for the replacement satellite, and NOAA now says there's going to be there's a high risk of an 18-month gap. We're not going to be able to see some of the things that we desperately need to see in order to prepare for these kinds of extreme events. It's like, you know, not only are we not taking the foot off the accelerator, but now we're being told we can't look out the window of the car to see what's coming, and I just think that's short-sighted.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about climate change, about the flooding in the Mississippi. Larry Banks, consulting hydraulic engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers. Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute. And Ed Link, former director of research and development at the Army Corps. And he's a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland in College Park. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com and join the discussion. Leave your comments there. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Now you can support Science Friday and try something for free. Here's how.
This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite is designed to automatically back up files on PCs and Macs before hard drive crashes, viruses, theft, or other computer problems occur. In the event of a computer disaster, Carbonite helps restore photos, music, financial records, and other important files. Carbonite comes with anytime, anywhere access to your backed up files from any computer or via a smartphone or iPad app. To learn more about Carbonite and get a free trial, go to carbonite.com and enter the code SCIENCEFRIDAY. To secure your files and support Science Friday, go to carbonite.com and enter the code Science Friday. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone, for your attention. Now back to the show.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the flooding on the Mississippi with Larry Banks, Peter Glick, and Ed Link. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Larry, has the Army Corps changed its philosophy on managing the river over the years, considering the possibility of perhaps taking down some levees, allowing more minor floods, moving people away from the floodplains, as some of my guests have suggested?
We've evaluated alternatives like that, and as we formulate projects, and many of the new projects are formulated to look at things similar to that. I also looked at the room for the river concept that the Dutch are considering, and out of those nine basic elements that they're looking at over there, we probably have implemented about six of them on the Mississippi River and Tributaries project, and so, but we have not looked at concepts like just a full-scale moving of the levee system to widen the floodplain, because you've got to make such a drastic change from the landscape out there to get much lowering on the river. And the reason for that is because the levees are located along the high top bank on the river. The river has deposited the materials over long spans of time and created a high top bank, and that's where the initial levees that were probably built with slave labor on a lot of them were built, and then the levee alignments just continued along that alignment. And it's away from the river. We've got a wide floodplain. We've got a tremendous amount of wildlife and fisheries resources within that floodplain of the river. And we don't have a system where levees are just built right up on the top bank. Many of the cutoffs that we built back in the 30s and 40s, I think we had 16. Every one of them left the bend of the river that has become just a tremendous mecca for fish and wildlife. And the folks that live, particularly the ones down south like me, have come to enjoy over the years. So the bar pits, bar rope pits, where the material for the levees come from, are on the riverside of the levee in most instances. It's tremendous fishing habitat. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a floodplain that is probably unequaled in the rest of the world if you take it as a whole as far as environmental habitat along a riverine system. So I think the system fits itself pretty well with some of the things that the Dutch are looking at.
Ed Link, any comment?
It is a system, and I agree with Larry that it's it would be very difficult to move the those structures. And I, as I said before, I think the big issue is not engineering; it's real estate. And just as we tend to have infrastructure built up right against the 100-year flood line on the FEMA flood insurance maps, you tend to have have development occurring behind the levees where they are now. So there's some real practical reasons why it would be a big challenge to do that. Mm-hmm. The Dutch are looking at a real systems approach with regard to the future over there because of the their vulnerability, but also the threat from both sides, the threat from higher river flows for the same thing that Peter said, from early snow melt and more rainfall events on snow in the spring, and also sea level rise. And so they have this problem of what to do about both of those. We're faced with a similar kind of problem, not nearly the order of magnitude as the Dutch.
We run out of time, Jed. I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us. Larry Banks, consulting hydraulic engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers, former chief of water management at the Mississippi Valley Division in Vicksburg. Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland, and he's also a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Ed Link, former director of research and development for the Army Corps and a research professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, University of Maryland in College Park. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Support for Science Friday comes from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.
Great mathematician John Nash, the subject of a movie A Beautiful Mind, once described his delusions from schizophrenia in this way. Quote, "I started to see crypto-communists everywhere. I started to think I was a man of great religious importance and to hear voices all the time. I began to hear something like a telephone call in my head from people opposed to my ideas. The delirium is like a dream from which I seem never to awake. Scientists have observed these sorts of symptoms in many schizophrenic patients. But the big mystery is what exactly causes the hallucinated conversations or the tendency schizophrenics have to slip from one topic to another in mid-sentence or to mix themselves up in these intricately imagined plots. How do you figure all that out? Well, one way is to look at a bunch of computer patients. Computers programmed to have a similar sort of behavior, and that's what my next guest has done, and his cyber tinkering has allowed him to derive some new theories about schizophrenia. That research appears in the journal Biological Psychiatry. Dr. Ralph Hoffman is professor of psychiatry at Yale University's School of Medicine in New Haven, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you very much. Very pleased to speak with you here.
What made you try to create a model on a computer about schizophrenia?
Well, primarily because these are such vexing manifestations of schizophrenia that are so still so poorly understood. And then along with that, there are so many theories and ideas about what might be causing these problems. So what we ended up doing essentially is developing an artificial neural system implemented on computer, an artificial brain, simplified, but basically then inducing a wide range of hypothesized illness mechanisms and to see which one actually seemed to produce the better fit in terms of what we were seeing clinically and experimentally with actual patients.
And so do you have any idea what's behind the, you know?
Well, that's the big question. So we simulated about eight different core disturbances and with this system and compared it, as I said, to human behavior. And both the artificial neural systems and the humans were given tasks of remembering and recalling stories. So and actually what surfaced was a clear-cut, at least statistical, winner in terms of the problem that did the best in terms of simulating these patients, and that was what we now term as hyperlearning.
So you had one.
Yeah, we landed one.
landed hyperlearning, did you call it?
Yes, hyperlearning.
And what does that mean?
Well, what it means really is that in the artificial neural system, that particular modules, networks within the system were engaged in a learning process, so they were essentially fed stories of certain sorts, and they had to learn the stories and put them in an abstract form that enabled the stories to be actually downloaded into essentially a permanent memory in this artificial system. And then the system kind of unwound that process in the other direction, was able to take these memory traces and recreate the story. So what we found is essentially is if this memory consolidation process was accelerated to an excessive degree, that the system began to confuse different stories or memories and to corrupt these representations in very specific ways that seem to be suggestive of certain language manifestations of schizophrenia. And the reason why this is of potential importance is that in the real human brain, that when we have experiences interacting with others, seeing things on television, whatever, the common way that we parse these experiences and organize them and remember them for ourselves and to tell other people about it is through stories. So stories are a critical kind of organization for information, particularly social information, and really makes us who we are as individuals, the stories that we tell in some sense. So, so these stories, like other episodic memories, when we experience them and register them in memory, take a long, long time to become incorporated into a permanent store. So, And we don't, so what the study really suggests essentially, so we're talking weeks to months. So initially when we have these experiences and have memories in our minds about what we've gone through or what we've experienced or seen, that it's kind of a snapshot or a set of snapshots of these experiences. But then gradually these are incorporated into more abstract story structures that are related to other stories that we have learned and remembered. So there's a generalization process and an efficiency-making process.
Is there any way that you can incorporate what you've learned from your computers into helping people?
Yeah, well, just to finish out the story. So what it really says is the reason why the human brain has to do this so slowly is that if it actually speeds it up, that that memories become intermingled and corrupted in certain ways, and it might actually, we're hypothesizing, produce the manifestations of what we call schizophrenia.
And as far as helping people now, using what you know?
Well, what we need to do is press on, and we need to do some, we have, I think, an interesting hypothesis and some preliminary supporting data, because this study was actually done in comparison to a group of actual patients. What we need to do now is to look directly in the brains of these individuals and to see if this hyperlearning process can be confirmed, not just through their manifest language behavior, but using certain kinds of neuroimaging. So that's what we're pursuing now.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Ralph Hoffman, professor of psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine in New Haven. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Next up, Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
You've got something special, of course.
Of course. This week we have a home science experiment, but you do need a sunny day. It's fun in the sun science.
Summer science. Summer science.
And I did this a lot as a kid, and I didn't even know that there was some kind of lesson I could learn while I was doing it. So here's what you need. You need the sun, and you need a magnifying glass. And I think probably most people know where I'm going with this. If you put your magnifying glass up to the sun, you can concentrate the sun's rays and torture insects, which we do not recommend.
No. No insect was harmed in the making of your video,
that's
right?
That's true. No insects were harmed. But we did light some dead leaves on fire. So maybe adult supervision.
I love the smell of leaves when you get that little sun. We've all done that, right? You take the magnifying glass, you focus it on some leaves.
Right.
And they catch on fire.
Right. It seems like magic, but yes. It turns out that it's optics.
Mm-hmm.
So we spoke with Tom Barrett at Stanford, and he is a physicist who kindly explained what is going on when you're doing this. And I think, you know, most of us know that you're bending the light to this focal point, and that's why, and it's more concentrated, and so you've got more light in a littler area. You're squeezing more sunshine into a smaller area.
Right.
But you can actually calculate, it turns out, how much energy or how much more intense that little spot is than the sunlight that's hitting your hand, for example, with an equation.
Wow, and you show us how to do that on your video. It's our video pick of the week up there in the corner on the left-hand side of sciencefriday.com. And you take us through that, and it's fascinating.
I was really amazed. It turns out, we did this with ours. You have to know the diameter of your lens, and you have to know the focal length, which just requires a ruler. But we found out that our magnifying glass was concentrating the light 1,000 times.
1,000 times.
1,000 times
what it was just be falling on your hand.
That's right.
That's why you could burn a leaf with it.
That's right. So that is a magnifying glass. So you think, wow, 1,000 times, that is a lot. But mm-hmm. what Tom Baer told us is that, you know, think about your eyeball, because it too has a lens in it that's focusing the light. And I don't know, spoiler alert here.
No, go ahead.
You should
still watch
the video. It's still cool.
Watch a great video. Yeah, okay.
It turns out that your eye actually concentrates the light 2,500 times, 2,500 times.
Your eye.
Your eye.
No wonder we don't want you to look at the sun.
This was a good explanation for why you should not look. You know, you see the leaves bursting into flames, and then you learn that your eye is sort of double that in intensity of concentration, and that was proof enough for me not to look at the sun.
Not even for a little bit, right?
No.
But you also a wonderful little aha that you have in the video.
Yes.
At the end.
Yes, at the end, you can see the sun. This was an aha from you, Ira, actually. But if you look through your magnifying glass, you actually are looking at the sun on the paper, right?
Yeah, if you focus, you can actually focus the sun. And if it's going through some dappled leaves like you have it there, you can actually see a beautiful picture of the sun and the leaves and everything,
yeah,
right on a piece of paper on a sidewalk even.
Yeah, we had a kind of a nice scenescape because we were on a roof in New York, and so we had some tall buildings and some clouds going across the sun. But it was pretty cool. I didn't know that this...
Yeah,
this
and that's how when I was a kid, or when that's how you look at an eclipse. You don't look at the sun. You know, if you take a box and you put your head in it and you put a pinhole in it, right? Well, the pinhole's like a lens.
Right.
And the sun will just focus on the paper. And we did that
With the magnifying glass.
And
you can do that, too, with a, you know, $2 magnifying glass.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much. This is a pretty easy experiment to do at home. And it's more than just a fire hazard. I found out.
And no animals or insects are involved.
We strongly do not recommend involving living things.
Yes. The dry leaves are wonderful. Even the wet leaves you were using them on, it was 1,000 times the folk. Wow. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Yeah. I'm Ira Flatto, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.